Let's turn to the passage that Ruth read to us. And depending on your age this evening, and I'm not trying to discriminate against any group of people, young people especially are told today that they may have to be prepared for career changes in their lives. Now, it used to be the case that in many people's lives, they trained for a certain career or job, and they were able to follow that job or career all the way through their working life, because there was a continuing requirement for whatever it is that they did. But we know that the workplace, as it's called today, is changing constantly. And what was a required occupation in years gone by might not be needed in years to come. And someone might serve an apprenticeship or gain a degree or some other training in a certain career, and they go out into the world of work and they find a good job, and then perhaps 10, 15, 20 years down the line, there's really little call for such an occupation because automation has come, technology has taken over, and we all know situations where that happens, and we may know people to whom it happened, and it may even be that it's happened in your life. And so young people today, as part of their education and training, we might say, need to be prepared for the fact that there may well be career changes coming along the way. It happened to my son, not perhaps in the way I quite described, but he got a degree and then went to work, and then after about 10 years he decided that he wanted to be a teacher. Now, he'd always sworn that he wasn't going to be a teacher. He'd had a taste of it and it really put him off. But after 10 years he began to realise that it actually was what he wanted to do. And so there was a big career change. He went off to university again. He took a year's course and trained to be a teacher, and now he is a teacher. And as far as I'm able to judge, not that I'm an expert in these things, I think he's a good teacher as well. So it's happening more and more these days. Now, the reason why I say those things is because here in Nehemiah we've got a man who's undergoing a very radical career change. You probably know that at the beginning of the book he's the king's cupbearer. He's the one who serves wine to the king. Now, of course, that wasn't the only thing he did. Almost certainly, he would have been responsible for making sure that the king's wine cellar was fully stocked with the best of wines, of course. After all, this was the king, the emperor of a vast empire. He could afford all these things, and Nehemiah would have been the person who is responsible for making sure that everything was well stocked, and that the king's slightest wish in these areas, he was the one who would have to fulfil those wishes. So it wasn't just literally handing a goblet of wine to the king whenever he wanted it. It would have been much more than that, and there would have been a great responsibility in what he was doing. And we might say, well, you know, that's a really comfortable job in many ways. As long as the king looks upon you with favour, as long as you can stay in the job and do it well, then everything's looking rosy for you, and you can look forward to years and years in this nice comfortable job, and possibly a nice comfortable retirement afterwards as well. But things are going to change for Nehemiah, as we read about in chapter 2. He's going to stop being the cupbearer. He's going to make a long, arduous journey, probably the best part of 1,000 miles, which in those days was really arduous, and he's going to be in charge of a massive rebuilding project. That's what it amounted to. Just imagine if someone said to you, you're in charge of building a defensive wall all the way round Colchester. Just think of the size of Colchester now. Put the wall where you will, you know, think of outlying areas if you want to make it even more daunting a task, but even if you just took the inner part of Colchester and you were tasked with building a defensive wall all the way round, you would say that was a pretty massive responsibility. And that's what Nehemiah is taking on here. So he's moving out of the palace, all of its comfort and security, and he's going on this long, arduous journey to this capital city of Jerusalem, and he's going to be in charge of this rebuilding project. And all the responsibility, in the end, is going to come down on his shoulders. I don't know whether Nehemiah had a desk, but you might know the story that Harry Truman, who took over from Franklin Roosevelt at the very end of World War II, and actually it was Harry Truman, I believe, who made the fateful decision to drop the atom bombs, Harry Truman had a little notice on his desk, and it says, "The buck stops here." That's where that phrase comes from. And he knew that in the end, he was the one responsible for making the decisions. Oh yes, there were generals and politicians who would handle the details and the nitty-gritty, as we say, but in the end, he was the one who had to shoulder the responsibility of making these great, earth-shaking decisions in some cases. Now, Nehemiah didn't have the responsibility that Harry Truman had, but as far as the rebuilding project was concerned, the buck stopped with him. He had to make the decisions, he had to face the opposition, he had to deal with the internal squabbles and difficulties that were going to arise. It all came back to him in the end. So we're going to have a look at Nehemiah tonight with the help of the Holy Spirit, and we're going to think to ourselves about the example that he sets up, and then some other aspects of what was going on here as we draw to a close. But I hope it's in your heart to serve God like Nehemiah. Why otherwise would he go and give up this comfortable job to such an uncertain future? The simple answer, of course, was because he strongly believed that God had called him to do that, and it was in his heart to serve God. So I hope that we're all in the same frame of mind this evening, that we do want to serve God. Or obviously we serve in different ways and different capacities, but are we looking in that direction, if I may put it like that? Are we thinking, yes, I do want to serve God? Well, if that's the case, then have a look at Nehemiah and think about the example that he sets us, even from all those thousands of years ago. So four ways, first of all, in which Nehemiah sets us a good example. First of all, he was prepared to make sacrifices. We've already emphasised that in essence, haven't we? Give up a comfortable job with all its nice prospects and everything set fair for the rest of his life. Give up all of that and go to this situation in Jerusalem, which must have looked to him to be very uncertain. You know, all the walls are broken down, so at the start there's going to be no protection against our enemies or anything like that. It's going to be really, really difficult. And yet Nehemiah was prepared to give up that comfort and security to make that difficult journey and to take on what, humanly speaking, might have been a very unattractive and difficult project to rebuild these walls. And he was prepared to do it, all because he was convinced that that was what God wanted from him. It was as simple as that. He hadn't been thinking about that originally, but as you read through chapter 1, he gets to know the state that Jerusalem is in, and it begins to touch his heart, and he begins to pray about it, and he asks God to do something about it. And if we may put it like this, God pointed his finger at Nehemiah and said, "Okay, Nehemiah, you're the person to do something about it." We can put it as simply as that, if you like. And Nehemiah responded, "I am prepared to make big sacrifices in order to do the job that you've given to me, Lord." So that's the first example that he sets us. Here's the second one. He knew how important prayer was in actually accomplishing the project that he was set out to do. Okay? For example, in chapter 1, you actually add it up, two-thirds of chapter 1 is about praying. That's what he does. When he finds out what a terrible state Jerusalem is in, he starts praying. And in chapter 2, And you might already be very familiar with this. We have in verse 4 what's sometimes called a narrow prayer. Okay? The king said to me, I'm reading from the New King James Version here, what do you request? So I prayed to the God of heaven. Okay? There we are. The king has put him on the spot. Okay, Nehemiah, what do you want? And in that moment, Nehemiah prays to God. It must have been an instantaneous prayer, wasn't it? I don't think that Nehemiah would have been brave enough to say to the king, well, could you just give me a couple of days while I go away and pray about this, because I'm not really sure what I should say to you at this moment. It had to be something instantaneous, didn't it? Lord, help me in this moment, because I really know how important this moment is. You know, it could go one way, it could go the other. The king could be really angry with me, and he could even sack me from my current job, or the king could be really sympathetic towards me and actually go along with this thought that's been materialising in my brain for the last few weeks. Which is it going to be? I don't know, but Lord, please help me. So there can be those instantaneous prayers, you see. Maybe someone asks you a question and you haven't expected it. You need God's wisdom there and then. Lord, please help me. Perhaps there's somebody who comes knocking on your door with a message from some kind of sect or cult. And they ask you a question or they put something to you. How are you going to respond? Lord, help me. I really don't know what to say in this moment. I don't know the best thing to say. Or somebody at work. Your neighbour calls in with a problem. Lord, help me in this situation. I really need to know what to say. So Nehemiah knew how important prayer was. And the question to us is, do we feel the same need to pray, whether it's what we might call a lengthy prayer when we're on our own and we're quietly praying to God, or whether it's that instantaneous arrow prayer in the moment of decision? Do we recognise the need to pray because something important perhaps is hanging on the decision, the outcome that comes from this situation? So here's something that Nehemiah tells us all. We need to pray. There are going to be other things as well, but prayer needs to surround and overshadow everything we're looking to do for the Lord in his service. Because, let's all be honest here, sometimes we can say to ourselves, you know what, I've done this before, maybe several times. I've dealt with people on the doorstep. I know what to say to my family friend who comes to me with this problem, and we can just plough ahead. I know what to do, I can do it all on my own. Do we recognise the need to ask God for his help, be it ever so quickly, because of the needs of the situation, or are we saying, oh, I can do it on myself, I've done it before, I know exactly what to do, it's going to be a piece of cake. We're human, that's the way we often think, and we need to watch out for that kind of attitude. We all do it. Third example from Nehemiah, he was careful not to give unnecessary offence. Did you notice the phrases that he used? Now again, I'm going to quote from the New King James, but you'll have seen similar phrases in whatever Bible version you're using. He says in verses 5 and 7, if it pleases the king. In verse 5 he also says, I ask that you send me. He says, if your servant has found favour in your sight. You see, he's polite to the king. And it's something that we should well take note of. Now, let me just digress for a moment. We're going to come back to this in a moment. You might think I'm kind of shooting off at a tangent here, but when we speak to non-Christians about the gospel, we have to talk about sin. We have to talk about the judgment of God, and we have to talk about hell. We might not speak about them all every time we witness. There might be some particular feature of the gospel that we concentrate on in a particular situation. But if we're going to tell the whole story, we have to talk about these things sooner or later. Now that's what the Bible calls the offence of the cross, because they're things that people don't like very much and they find difficult to swallow. They find it difficult sometimes to be told that in God's eyes we're all sinners. They find it difficult to be told that there is a judgment coming and that God will judge sin. You see, and that's hard to swallow, isn't it, if you're not a Christian, particularly if you've been telling yourself all the way through your life, well, you know, I'm not really a very bad person and I know lots of people who are far worse than me, so surely God's happy with me and surely I can sneak into heaven even if it's only by the skin of my teeth. And to find out that we're sinners in God's sight and that we deserve his judgment, that can be really hard to swallow. And the Bible calls it the offence of the cross. And if we're going to be faithful servants of God, we've got to talk about those things. Yes, we might try and put them as sympathetically as possible and understanding that we were in the same position as they are now, but we've still got to speak about them. The problem comes if, as Christians, we start becoming a little bit rude and inconsiderate and unsympathetic when we're talking about those things, and that is possible. But the Bible says, and Nehemiah says, by his example, don't give unnecessary offence to people. Yes, talk about the gospel and sin and judgment, but don't give unnecessary offence by being rude or inconsiderate or anything else like that. In the New Testament, Paul said to the Corinthian Christians, he said, we put no stumbling block in the path of people. In other words, we're not going to do anything that will hinder, from a human point of view, them coming to know the Lord Jesus Christ as their Saviour and granting them forgiveness for all of those things that we have been speaking about. Paul says we put no stumbling block in anyone's path. And you see, if we start to become rude or impolite or inconsiderate or anything like that, then we're beginning to put stumbling blocks in people's paths and we're not helping them along that path that, in God's mercy, will lead them to salvation and forgiveness. So even in Nehemiah being polite to the king, there's a message for you and me and something that we need to take note of. One more thing that Nehemiah did that we can take as an example, he knew the value of preparation. Note that Nehemiah had answers ready for the king. So the king says, how long are you going to be away? And Nehemiah's got an answer. Nehemiah also knows that he's going to need letters of safe conduct. How is he going to get through all the other provinces that this king rules over before he gets to Judah? It's a long way, and he's got to pass through these other provinces. What's going to protect him on the way through? He knows that he needs letters of safe conduct, as we put it today. He also knows, very practical man, he's going to need timber to rebuild the city. The citadel and the walls and so on and so forth. He knows he's going to need all that, and so he says to the king, please can I have all that I need to authorise me to have that timber? So you see, all these things, as we might say, Nehemiah's got at his fingertips. He's ready with his answers. One more thing, did you notice in verse 8, he even knows the name of the keeper or the manager of the king's forest. Okay, so he's got all these things at his fingertips. Now where did they come from? Well, it's possible that God could have told him in an instantaneous answer to that instantaneous arrow prayer, this is what you need to do, Nehemiah, and by the way, here's the name of the keeper of the king's forest. I think it's much more likely, actually, that Nehemiah has done his homework. And he sat down, and yes, he's been praying a lot, but also in his mind, a plan had gradually been forming. Lord, I don't know how this is going to come about, but if the opportunity ever arises, I want to be ready. So I better have my blueprint ready, how long it's going to take, what I'm going to need, and Lord, I'll do my homework as best I can. Oh yes, I need to know the name of the keeper of the king's forest, so I've got an answer ready for the king, if the opportunity actually arises. So you see, we've got two sides to a coin here. We've got prayer, and we've got preparation. And they're both necessary in the work of God. Sometimes that prayer can only be an instant prayer. Sometimes our preparation can't be very long because we're shoved into a situation where suddenly, on the spur of the moment, we've got to do something. Years and years ago, I had a phone call from somebody holding a meeting at the university, a Christian meeting, and he said, we're starting at 7:30, this phone call was about 6 o'clock, we're starting at 7:30, and the speaker has pulled out, please can you come and take the meeting for us? So an hour and a half notice or something like that. And probably you may well have been put in a similar situation. Okay, so we can't do much preparation in that situation, and God knows about that. But in the ordinary course of events, we can pray about it, and we can prepare. Prepare as best you can, give it all the effort you possibly can, and then commit it to God in prayer, and leave the rest of it to God. And if the circumstances mean that you can't do one or the other, or even both of them, you can at least instantaneously ask God to help you, to make you wise, and to be able to serve Him as best as you possibly can. So there are some great examples that Nehemiah sets to us. Prepare to make sacrifices, knowing the value of prayer, knowing the value of preparation as well, and then also he was careful not to give unnecessary offence. So four great examples, but let me just in closing point up to you two other things that it's well for us to observe about Nehemiah. First of all, he had powerful opposition. We only got the first introduction to that, didn't we, in verse 10. When Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official heard of it, they were deeply disturbed that a man had come to seek the well-being of the people of Israel. So even while Nehemiah is on his journey to Jerusalem, there are people who get to hear about him coming, and they are not well pleased at all. They're angered by the thought of what he intends to do. They're probably people who were exploiting the situation of Jerusalem being defenceless, and they were determined to keep things just like that, so that they could continue exploiting that situation. So they don't like the idea of Nehemiah and his project one little bit. And they think that they've got the resources and their cunning to actually put a stop to what Nehemiah wants to do. As you read on in the book, you come across these people several times, and you find out the kind of things that they're prepared to get up to. All kinds of things. Threats, lies, ridicule, you know, anything that you could possibly think of, that's what they will try and do. But just for now, and by all means do when you get home or some other time, read the next few chapters and find out exactly what happens, because it's a really interesting story. But just for now, let's observe these things. First of all, these are powerful men. They are leaders in their own area. So they've got command of resources and manpower and so on to be able to do all kinds of things to interfere in the work that Nehemiah is intending to do. These are men with real power and influence. If you look on the map, you'll find out that they practically had Judah surrounded. So here's little Judah, and it's surrounded by these leaders and the countries or the provinces that they control. The only side of Judah that wasn't really surrounded was where the sea was. So we can say effectively on every landward side they were surrounded by these powerful people. And as you find out in later chapters, these people not only surrounded the country, they had powerful connections inside the Jewish community as well. They had insider information, and they knew what was going on, and they sometimes exploited those connections to be able to sow fear and mistrust and division within the Jewish community. So there's some really strong opposition going on here. So the lesson for you and me as Christians is this: we've got to be prepared when we're serving God for there to be opposition. Other people might try and interfere with what we're doing and oppose it. Satan always will. And whether it's a church activity or whether it's just something that you're doing as an individual, maybe in your street or in your workplace or in your family, you can be sure that some way or other Satan will try and oppose you. And he is a powerful enemy. And he's got resources that we can hardly understand or even comprehend. Now, I'm not saying that to scare you or to put you off serving, but we've got to be realistic and understand that we're not going to have a free hand in serving God and going out in the cause of the gospel. We have powerful opposition, just like Nehemiah had. But what we need to remember is this. Here's a quotation from the first letter of John in chapter 4. Greater is he that is in you than he that is in the world. In other words, God is greater than Satan. Even though Satan is so powerful and so wily, yet God is greater. And so the last lesson is that Nehemiah, yes, he had powerful opposition, but he also had almighty help. Here's a question. Why wasn't Nehemiah driven to give up as soon as he got to Jerusalem? When he saw the state that the walls were in and he realised how much opposition there was, why wasn't he driven to give up? The simple answer is because he believed God had called him and he believed God was going to help him every step of the way. Did you notice there, right at the end of verse 8, the king granted them to me all the things he'd requested according to the good hand of my God upon me. He was conscious that God had been helping him at that time, and he was sure that God was going to continue to help him even though there were many, many difficulties to confront. Now, that might not seem too much, but let me just introduce you to a bit of history here. You see, this very same king, not many years previously, had ordered the rebuilding project that had been kind of stuttering along. He'd ordered it to cease completely by force of arms if necessary. And Nehemiah would have known about that. We read about it in Ezra chapter 4. So what brought this king to change his mind? And the answer is simple: God's good hand upon me. At the right time, when Nehemiah was ready and prepared, God turned this king's heart, so to speak, from saying no more building into, yes, Nehemiah, by all means go and start building, and here's all the resources and everything you're going to need along the way. What changed the king's mind? Nehemiah was absolutely sure it was God's good hand upon me. And so when Nehemiah begins to speak to the people in Jerusalem and he wants to get them enthusiastic about the rebuilding project, look at verse 18. And I told them of the hand of my God which had been good upon me, and also of the king's words that he had spoken to me. So they said, let us rise up and build. Before, these people had been cowed into submission because the king had said, no more building, it all comes to a stop. But when Nehemiah tells them, the king's changed his mind and he's given me all these resources to carry out this project, the people say, right, we're on board, let's get going, let's roll our sleeves up and let's do the work. So it was the sense that God was with them that not only encouraged Nehemiah, but encouraged the residents of Jerusalem to get involved in the work as well. And it's all down in the end, as Nehemiah says constantly, to God's good hangs upon him. The God who could even change the mind of this king and bring him to a point where he would say, yes, you can rebuild now. So if you're a Christian serving God, never be surprised when you come up against some opposition. It won't be easy. There will be problems and there will be opposition. But you can be confident, if you're obeying God, that God's hand is upon you and that God will be with you as you seek to serve him. Copy Nehemiah's example. Be prepared for opposition, but trust in the almighty hand of God to be with you in each and every situation. And let's know, like Nehemiah, that God will bless us according to his will and purpose.